The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Medievalist. And today we're actually going to stay true to our name by dealing with something that's been a concern of mine for many, many years. And that is what sort of generalizations we can take from the Middle Ages, both Western and Eastern, that is to say, all those political entities that derive, to some extent, from Rome. That, of course, Rome itself, Byzantium, the Holy Roman Empire, both in Gaul and in Germany, and everything that occurs in the Eastern world, Serbia, Bulgaria, Kiev, Suzdal, Moscow, St. Petersburg. Can we draw anything from this mentality, this medieval mentality that was so important in European history, absolutely central to European history? What generalizations can we draw, in other words, from the history of political and social thought and the actual functioning of monarchy and its related institutions in the Middle Ages? And so that's our purpose for today. And in coming to these topics, we need to keep one specific thing in mind. We need to keep in mind a very important synod, synodal meeting of bishops in the city of Chalcedon in the 5th century, the first half of the 5th century. The Council of Chalcedon is one of those watersheds in the history of the Orthodox world and in the Orthodox mentality, whether it be Eastern or Western in background, that has to be understood in some detail before any idea of medieval political theory, medieval monarchy, medieval corporatism, and these things, we're still living with some of this mentality today. To understand Chalcedon is to understand the basis of medieval political ideas and from whence they come. What was the significance of Chalcedon? The Synod of Chalcedon in the beginning of the 5th century concerned one specific issue, and it sounds like a quibble to people who don't understand, but the reality is it was one of the most immensely significant decisions and very controversial decisions in the history of the Orthodox and the Catholic Church. The fact is that the main issue concerns the person of Jesus Christ. To what extent did the human element in Christ, Christ as a man, Christ as a specific person, and Christ as God, how did they function? Did they exist in a certain level of equality? Was there a hierarchical relationship between them? It sounds, for those who don't get it, it sounds like a minor issue, and yet the reality is it was central. Because the decision of Chalcedon absolutely defined the mentality of the Middle Ages from that point onward. And the decision of Chalcedon was, to put it very simply, that Jesus Christ is one person containing two essences or two natures. Those two essences are undivided. They are unconfused. They are not mixed in any way. And that is the divinity and the humanity of Jesus Christ as universal entities. It wasn't just as if Christ was a single human person, although he was that. He was not merely that. He also contained all of human nature, the form of human nature, the idea of human nature in its fullness was contained in him at the same time that the fullness of divinity was contained in him. The political and social upshot of all of this is that the human being, the human beings in the church and struggling within the church have a role to play in their own salvation. That there is a more or less autonomous human sphere that that cooperates of its own voluntary nature, cooperates with the divine. This is the cash value. The way that this that Chalcedon is made real is that it puts humanity on, to some extent, the same plane as divinity. They work together. They work together in the church, and they work together for the salvation of all those individuals who voluntarily accept Christ, the church, and that level of discipline that the ancient churches, both East and West, fully recognize, and of course mostly now have been thrown by the wayside in the interest of fashion. But humanity has an autonomous role to play. Humanity is, so to speak, a contracting party relative to divinity. And therefore, human needs, specific human needs, can never be removed from the life of divinity and hence from the life of the church. That changed a lot. In many ways, the mentality that came from Chalcedon has immense political value. And you have to understand that before any concept of medieval political ideas can ever make sense to anybody. And we're talking about really a basic mentality that traverses European history from Greece to Great Britain, from Spain to Moscow. That this mentality has to be understood before these institutions, all to whatever extent, based on the initial idea of the Roman Empire. So that's the first introductory issue. The second introductory issue is another complicated issue, and it concerns the relationship of nationalism to the Middle Ages. Speaking of the High Middle Ages, we're talking about a period of time roughly from the schism between East and West throughout the 11th century and the beginning of the 14th century. It's my contention that in various parts of Europe, but not Europe as a whole, there was a relatively strong but yet inarticulate concept of ethnicity. And you usually find this on the fringes of European life. There's no doubt in my mind that there is a very strong concept of ethnicity in the Celtic lands. And throughout the Middle Ages, it's not that hard to find chronicle accounts where they make reference to the different languages and the different ideas that attach to different ethnicities. The Celtic lands, I think, were probably the most well-developed in terms of ethnicity. You also see it in the East. You see it in the Greek world, you see it in Poland, and you see it in Russia. Russia, again, speaking very generally in that particular case. Here, the concepts of a specific language and a specific faith created this concept of an other. And this was the case with Lithuania, Poland, and Russia. Lithuania and Poland later on creating a dynastic union, really in order to face off with the Russian Empire. But the constant battles between Poland, Germany, again, Germany speaking very generally, and Russia, this created this three-way kind of otherness that helped define, fairly early on, the concept of nationality, and a concept of nationality that was very closely connected, in fact, intimately connected with the various religious ideas that were fighting one another in that part of the world. So, and of course, in the Greek world, it's very clear, very early on, in the Byzantine Empire, even as they were using the Latin language in the Byzantine Empire, and they used Latin for a long time, the fact is that being Greek was to be very different. being Greek was to be very different from those whose basic cultural background was Latin. And you see quite often Byzantine monarchs, particularly in you know, throughout the Middle Ages, really worrying about marrying off their daughters to non-Greek people, thinking that the Franks and the Slavs and the Vikings, that these people, that these were different ethnicities with different dominant languages and different cultures, cultures that were not quite up to, for better, I mean, I don't know, I'm not saying it's true, but the concept is that they believed that the Greek culture was the superior one. So throughout the Middle Ages, I just want to make the point that throughout the Middle Ages, you have a very strong idea of nationalism, idea of ethnicity, slowly but surely developing. I think the big difference between ethnicity in the Middle Ages and ethnicity in the 18th and 19th century was that for the most part, the concepts of ethnicity in the Middle Ages were not necessarily charged with a specific political approach. They were not politicized. They were cultural realities. They were culturally important. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they became political visions and political views. That came later on. But that doesn't mean that they were not active actors throughout the Middle Ages. I do, however, hold that the confrontation between Scandinavia and Ireland and then Norman England in Ireland, there is a place where ethnicity became very political. And there was a specific ethnic idea behind the Ócáid Church of Ireland, the Brian Laws, and these other things relative to the rest of the world. So there seems to be this concept of otherness, which is at the center here, that we can differentiate ourselves from our neighbors, and the fact that our neighbors are often hostile to us and have imposed some kind of suffering upon us, that also helps crystallize some concept of ethnicity, political or not. Certainly in Byzantium, after the sacking of New Rome, is what Byzantium was officially called, or the New Israel, which was another one of its very important names, that the difference between Latin and Frank as two religious entities, as two cultural entities, as two linguistic entities, in other words, all the basic ingredients of ethnicity was very clear and highly politicized. So I basically want to make this second introductory point to say that the Middle Ages knew nationalism, they knew ethnicity, it just wasn't nearly as politicized as it became in the 19th and in the 20th century. And that's also another important thing to keep in mind. So now for the rest of the time, what I hope to do is that I want to make a series of points concerning the basic nature of medieval political thought, both in the East and the West, when it comes to some general conclusions, with those first two introductory points in mind. So, point number one, you don't talk about the idea of a public law. The medieval world, no matter where you go, the medieval world was very law-based. For the most part, politics was based on the rule of law. But the medieval concept of law and the modern concept of law are two very, very different things. I want to say that, speaking very generally, public law in the Middle Ages is defined as the monarch, the ruling family. Well, this was not the case in Ireland or Scandinavia. This is mostly a continental idea. But that the monarch is the guardian of really of three things. A, the common good. B, justice. And C, the church. Those three things are at the root of royal thinking throughout the Middle Ages. In terms of common good, you need to understand that the monarch viewed himself as being above the other classes that made up society, realizing that these classes often had diametrically opposed interests. But a powerful monarch, you know, thinking of like a Basil II in Byzantium, a Charlemagne, Otto III in Germany, these kind of people, Alfred in England, they were powerful enough and they were popular enough to be able to impose their will over and above the contending classes in society. And you have a long history of the lower classes looking to the monarch for protection against their social betters, people who were wealthier and more powerful than they were, because the reality was that royal power existed in an inverse proportion to noble power, to the power of the aristocracy. It's fairly rare that those entities worked together. They normally worked at cross purposes. And so as a result, you had a triangle in medieval life between nobility, the lower classes, whether they be in the towns or in the countryside, and the monarchy. The monarchy being able to mediate between the upper and lower classes in society, again, speaking very generally. So there was a concept of the common good. There was a concept of a polity, a commonwealth that the monarch ruled in the interest of all, not people, but in all classes, all communities. Do not think in individual terms. You deal with the Middle Ages, you have to think in communal terms. But these relationships ultimately come from Plato. They ultimately come from the medieval concept of justice, that people had an assigned role in society. That role had very specific benefits and very specific obligations. Justice was defined as the individual within those communal obligations being ruled according to custom and having these customary ideas and customary laws, speaking very generally, always being operative in defining the nature of the relationship among the different classes. That really is the nature of justice. A monarch didn't come to power with this idea that I'm going to change everything. Monarch came to power with the idea that I am going to preserve and streamline the nature of these kind of communal relationships. Generally speaking, monarchs did not believe that they had the right to alter custom. They only had the obligation to preserve it, work out the problems with it, work out any contradictions within custom, and see that all the various classes and entities within society lived according to these customary limits. Generally speaking, when you see a medieval rebellion, usually what you're seeing is old custom being trampled upon by one group or another. That's normally what you see in the development of medieval ideas of customary law. And, of course, the church. The church, whether Western or Eastern, was seen as the spiritual authority, the divine side of this Chalcedonian formula. Christ is both completely man and completely God. Therefore, in social relations, it doesn't take a genius to figure out how this is going to work in terms of social relations. The monarch is in charge of human concepts and human needs and desires, while the church is in charge of spiritual needs. Whether you are in Serbia or in England, that's basically the same approach. And regardless of how powerful a monarch was, as a matter of course, they did not, they may have manipulated the church, they may have robbed the church, they may have taken money from it, but it's extremely rare, even in the harshest of rulers, it's extremely rare that monarchs sought to interfere with doctrine. And that's something to take very, very seriously. There's an old myth, that Constantine somehow imposed his will on the first ecumenical synod, and yet a serious look at the literature that surrounds that first ecumenical synod says exactly the opposite. That since Constantine was not baptized at the time, he had no right to take part in the synod whatsoever, and Constantine himself was very clear that he had no authority in this synod. His authority simply reached as far as being able to keep order within the deliberations, and that's about it. to hold that Constantine imposed his will, or that later monarchs, even including Justinian and others, imposed their will on synods, is a highly problematic idea, and it is not borne out by literature, both primary and secondary sources of the era. And that's really simply proven by the fact that you had as many heretical emperors as Orthodox emperors who sought to impose their will upon the church and were rebuffed if they called the synod, and the synod passed the emperor's desires. Usually that was reversed after the emperor's death. So, I mean, you have this, again, speaking very generally, you have this idea that even the harshest of rulers generally did not seek to manipulate the Christian doctrine. And that's an idea that needs to be taken very seriously. And it's an idea that derives from a number of facts, but Chalcedon is probably the most important one. If you have the idea that Christ is two essences, two natures to be found in one person, then society is always going to be cut in half between the spiritual things and the physical things. But that doesn't mean that society is cut in half in reality. It is just as Christ is one man, the society is one integral entity made up of two very general parts. And without understanding that, medieval political theory doesn't make much sense. Another concept, the second concept that's very important here, is the notion of a monarch's domain does go beyond your basic day-to-day feudal customs. The idea of creating immunities, the idea of giving recognition to specific communities such as guilds and such as religious organizations, this was actually a manifestation of sovereignty. But the manifestation of sovereignty in these cases, they do little more than put a royal blessing upon what has already existed. And by giving a royal blessing upon a guild, providing it with certain benefits like freedom from taxes, being able to collect tolls in a certain bridge in town or whatever it is, these kind of things are manifestations of the monarch's sovereignty. And so sovereignty here is not so much seen as ruling in sort of the modern sense, where a president or a dictator or a military government can manipulate society according to its own needs. Sovereignty was seen as providing protection, providing some kind of institutional structure to slowly developing customary organizations and institutions. So the third point is that the monarchy, wherever you are, is seen as the primary motive force in society, and is seen most of all, and this is another way of looking at the concept of sovereignty here, he's seen as the final court of appeal. If someone cannot get justice at the municipal level, if someone cannot get justice at the customary level, they may be able to get justice in the final court of appeal, that of the monarch. So in this idea, which you find in all of these coronation oaths and all of these other things, in terms of a royal self-understanding, this idea that I can go over the heads of the powerful in the interest of justice is something very important. That as the final court of appeal, my word is law. When something comes to me from the lower orders and there's some sort of problem in the administration of justice at the lower orders. The fourth point, as the last thing I'll say before the break, the fourth point is the monarchy is seen as a remedy. Monarchy is not a normal state of affairs. I want to make this very, very clear. Monarchy is proof. The medieval idea, again, I'm speaking very generally here, there's plenty of people who would disagree. But the monarchy is proof that mankind is fallen, mankind is evil, mankind is power-hungry and egocentric. And so having an institution that has a free hand in dealing particularly with powerful people who overstep their customary bounds in the interest of aggrandizing their own position, and putting them back into their place in the best sense of that word, that is one of the main props of royal rule. If Adam had never sinned, monarchy would never be necessary. Monarchy is necessary because Adam has sinned. Monarchy is necessary because human beings inherit the propensities towards egocentrism and self-worship that come from that fall into sin. Okay, we'll continue this concept, this talk on medieval political ideas, medieval monarchy, after the break.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, we've been talking today about medieval political ideas, generally speaking, throughout Europe, in the High Middle Ages, and if you know a little bit before, as deriving from the Council of Chalcedon. And what we're dealing with here is the Council of Chalcedon, the beginning of the 5th century, in defining Christ's person as, in fact, being made up of two essences united in one individual, and that is the essence of humanity and the essence of divinity. Medieval political ideas derive directly from that concept. And you know, you have people like Pope Gelasius, who in the early Middle Ages takes this formula very seriously. And in dealing with Western Europe, makes it clear that we're talking about two entities in any given society. The spiritual sword that deals with the church and the sacraments, a lot of moral issues, marriages, etc., and the political sword that deals with the day-to-day life of the relations between classes and communities and guarding the nature of the customary relations between these two things. But just as Chalcedon says that there are two essences to be found in the person of Christ, later synods also made the claim, and it's believed by Christians of both Eastern and Western background, that those two entities, those two essences to be found in the person of Christ, also had their own independent wills synthesized in the person of Christ. So there is a spiritual will. There is a set of spiritual desires that need to be ordered and a set of political and social desires that need to be ordered. And this is the absolute basis of all medieval political ideas. You have one source. All material things come from God. The laws that they live by come from God, but they have two very specific manifestations. The one is the life of the church, and the other is the life of the state, or the life of social action. And I want to make it clear that modern concepts of the state did not exist at this time. Politics was a very different sort of a word in the Middle Ages than it is today, but suffice it to say that we're talking about one very specific thing. We're talking about custom in relation to how the different classes and orders of society interact. I want to say something else, too. After the schism between East and West, and I'm not one of these people that take the year 1054 as some sort of a magic period of time. This schism was a long time coming and took a long time to fully manifest itself. Somewhere between 1054 and the sack of Byzantium by the Crusaders in 1204, that period of time sees a general estrangement between East and West. 1204, the sack of Constantinople, just makes it permanent, where now there is no chance of the two sides coming together. After the schism, after the traditional date of the schism in 1054, the beginning of the 12th century, you see a reform movement in the West, which is a reaction to the split between East and West. It occurs in 1054. Within a couple of generations, after that period of time, within a couple of generations, the papacy will centralize itself, will radically reform itself. And it's not an accident that these reforms, we call them in general the Gregorian reforms, that these reforms come at the same time, not only right after the split between East and West, where now the papacy needs to redefine itself relative to now this new world, but it also needs to redefine and centralize itself relative to something that it considers a threat. And that is the slow but sure development of what we call later on the idea of the national monarchy. The monarchy in two places specifically, in Gaul and then later on in Germany, where as monarchs, you see this in the post-Carolingian age in Gaul, as well as in the Ottonian age and later on in Germany, you see the very slow but definitely noticeable centralization of royal power based on some of the ideas that I've already mentioned. But the Pope begins accusing, and this is a regular accusation done throughout the Middle Ages, the Pope accuses the emperors of taking their position in the hierarchy too far. It's something that needs to be taken very seriously, because what begins to happen is that monarchs begin to take center stage in the appointment of bishops, in the taking of certain church revenues and monastic revenues, and spending these on projects of state development. You see this throughout the Byzantine history. You see this in Russian history, to the point where his Metropolitan Philip confronts Ivan the Terrible, saying that he has gone too far in his building of Russian power. In Russian history, prior to Ivan the Terrible, the church backed the centralization of the various Russian states, largely complete by the time of Ivan the Third. Ivan the Terrible is known as Ivan the Fourth, with Basil the Third in between, because it solidified Orthodox power and it eliminated the fratricidal wars that had existed among the various states in Russia prior to this centralization. But there did come a point where the centralization had gone too far, and it was the case that some churchmen had condemned Ivan the Terrible. It was also the case that many churchmen had condemned the usurpations of power from Peter the Great and his successors, leading to Peter the Great purging the church, essentially creating two entities, creating the synodal system that he dominated, and then creating the church, the old believers, as well as later on the Cossack movement and the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which comes from the Patriarch of Jerusalem, that these eventually became different entities. But even there, Peter the Great, probably the most violent and overarching of all the monarchs of this era, and of course Peter the Great is in the beginning of the 18th century, so it was much later than the Middle Ages, Peter the Great never attempted to alter doctrine. He wanted to alter everything but doctrine. And his alterations actually affected the day-to-day operations of the church. Absolute monarchy is not derived from the Middle Ages. There was no such entity. There was no such thing as an absolute monarch in the Middle Ages. Monarchs understood, well, first of all, they did not have the technology to develop into absolute rulers. And when I say absolute, I'm talking about several different things. I'm talking about the concept of being at least in theory above the law. In practice, it was very rarely the case that monarchy moved beyond established custom. And they knew that there was a high price to pay for going beyond custom. Warfare, as always, was sort of a way that that could be done with minimal public complaining. But the other concept of absolutism is absolute responsibility. And this is something very important. Absolute responsibility means the health and welfare of the realm is entirely in the hands of the monarch, and when he dies, he will be answerable to God for the condition of his kingdom. People like Ivan the Terrible, Ivan the Fourth, took this very seriously. And he was very, very concerned. Ivan the Terrible was a particularly sensitive individual. And, you know, when he had to take harsh action against a rebellious noble family, for example, he would often fast for a very long period of time and engage in church processions and rituals for a long period of time, because he wasn't entirely sure, did I go too far, in which case I'm a tyrant, or did I not go far enough? Either way, I'm responsible for the final outcome of this, even if it's not my fault. I am still responsible before Russia, before all classes of society, and I'm responsible before God when I die. And it's something that particularly your stronger monarchs, people like Otto III and people like Ivan and people like Basil II in Byzantium, these people took very seriously. And they viewed, like Marcus Aurelius in the Roman Empire, they viewed power as a burden. This is not something that people want or should want. And Queen Victoria in England made the famous phrase concerning female suffrage at the time. She said, I can't believe women want to have a job as disgusting as ruling a society. Power is a crushing responsibility. And in an age where, you know, the overwhelming majority of the population believed in Christ-saving power and the church and the final judgment, being a ruler was a horrible position. You were responsible for everything. And the condition of the realm was entirely on your shoulders at Judgment Day. And they all most certainly believed in the judgment where they, in fact, would be held responsible for their actions. And it tortured these people. This is one of the reasons why it became customary throughout the medieval world, and specifically in the East, it became customary for monarchs to take monastic vows at the time of their, or close to the time of their death. It was common for medieval monarchs to retire near the time of their death and to take monastic vows. This is also the reason that Constantine didn't become baptized. Didn't get baptized until almost the time of his death, because he feared that stuff that I need to do as monarch is not part of Christian morality, and therefore, since baptism forgives all sins, I'm going to make certain it's really not until I'm pretty much old and out of the picture, then I'll become baptized. It also meant that he could not take part in church life because he was not baptized. But at the same time, it's something that he did extremely sensitive to the obligations of royal rule. So the concept here is that we're talking about two entities. We're talking about the royal area of authority, which corresponds to the humanity in Christ's person, as well as the will that derives from that specific entity. We're also talking about the church, then, as the spiritual side, corresponding to Christ's divine nature and that specific will. And just like Christ unified all of that in his person, society as a whole was considered as an organic unity, taking into itself all of these entities, the spiritual and the physical. They were not alien to each other. They were not alien to each other. Matter is a form of the spiritual. The spiritual is a form of the material. This is something that also comes out of the Council of Chalcedon, that matter and spirit are not radically opposed entities. They are not opposites in the radical sense of that word, where they cannot be synthesized. In fact, Christ's person is proof that those two worlds can be synthesized. And that concept of synthesis is at the background of all medieval political thinking. But I wanted to say that the concept of royal absolutism, which develops later on in European history, really has three sources. The first is that the monarch is elected by divinity. The monarch is a vicar of Christ on earth. This derives from the fact that a monarch is generally not elected, but derives from a certain royal family, and through birth and then training, they are brought to the throne. Now, there have been plenty of times where monarchs have been elected. In Russia, Ivan the Terrible was elected. In the middle of his reign, he retires. He is begged by all classes of society to come back. Tsar Michael, the first Romanov on the throne, was also elected by a council of the realm, of all classes. You see this throughout European history. There are periods of time where a council, or a series of councils of the upper classes, of clergy, are able to elect a monarch. But generally speaking, these elections, whether it be by birth or by election by classes in society, these were seen as a manifestation of the spirit. So there was a concept that I am not necessarily responsible to people, to the society. I'm responsible to God for what I do in society. The second idea, of course, is hereditary right. That the concept of inheriting the throne means that politics and things political are not involved in my election. I don't owe anyone anything when I come to the throne. And it's something that should be taken seriously because of the nature of modern politics, where it's essentially money and media control that decides who's going to be elected in any race. And these people will then keep out any serious critic from even having a chance in an election. At least with the hereditary principle, these kind of things are out of the question. And then a monarch is born and raised with the understanding and the education that he is going to rule one day. And the third idea is that while law is important, law is the backbone of the realm. Custom is how classes relate within, among themselves, each class relative to themselves, and then classes interacting with each other within society. Both of these things are important. We understand that the law doesn't take everything into account. The law doesn't take every specific thing into account, and therefore there has to be moments where a monarch can step above the law and make a decision in the interest of justice. And certainly that's been the case in the American system, where basically law is made by the court system. And any law that may be passed by a Congress or by a state legislature, whatever it is, can easily be overturned or radically altered by courts at a later time. And hence, when a law is being passed by or being signed by the president, it should be met with a yawn, because you never really know what courts are going to do to it afterwards. So, you know, the West loves to claim that it's based on the rule of law. Of course, it's based on the rule of judges, on the rule of money, and on the rule of by the media. And royal writers in the 19th and 20th century had a tendency to stress this, that there is no rule of law. Law is made by those that big money and big media are able to elect. It's very difficult to deny that. And so, you know, democracy, republicanism, these things are, in essence, oligarchies. So humanity generally speaking, really only has two choices. Is oligarchy to rule or is monarchy to rule? And I want to say that monarchy is not inconsistent with nationalism, certainly not the case in Russia or in the Cossacks in Ukraine or in Serbia, Hungary, and elsewhere. These two things are not necessarily at loggerheads. They can be, but they don't have to be. And that really is the nature of royal social ideas in the Middle Ages. I'm speaking very generally. I'm trying to come from, you know, general to conclusions from the data that's out there. And, you know, the basic concept is that all things come from God. The spiritual power comes from Him. The political power comes from Him. And that derives in turn from the idea that natural laws, the laws that govern the interaction of objects, you know, back then it was largely the work of Aristotle that kind of laid all of this out, but these also come from God. And so if natural laws come from God, then human laws must also correspond to that. And that really is the basis of monarchy. It's the basis of monarchy throughout the Middle Ages and even into the modern period in European life. So I know this has been very general and very abstract, but this is something very important to the European heritage from Ireland to Moscow, from Scandinavia to Sicily. And I want to say that it's something that needs to be understood in some detail, not just its political functioning, but its spiritual functioning, and the basis and the theory on which this rests. And just as democracy regularly deviates from its own theoretical view of itself, often monarchy deviated from the theoretical view of itself. And I want to poke fun at these people who attack royalists by, you know, they attack the actual functioning of monarchy, and they attack it from the point of view of democracy considered in its ideal form. So they treat of democracy as a set of ideas, and they treat monarchy as a set of actual actions in history. So, but if we're going to compare monarchy to democracy or republicanism, we have to compare actual functioning monarchs in history to actual functioning republics in history. Only then can we come to a rational conclusion. So this is a part of our heritage. This is kind of a big deal. And I want to say that I think, in general, royal societies were more rational than modern republican societies, which are overwhelmingly ruled by money and media control. So I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank my supporters. Oh, and I want to say one last thing before I go. I only very rarely get on the internet. If you're leaving me messages on the blog, I never get them. Please contact me on the email contact that's on the Voice of Reason Network. Contact me that way. I only get online when I absolutely have to. I'm not ignoring you. I just very rarely am on the internet. I check email once a day, and that's pretty much it. So I want you guys to know if you have any I know there's been a lot of questions and comments directed to me, and I appreciate that, but please send it to my email. Don't put it on the blog because I never see those. Anyway, for all of my friends as well as all my enemies, I want to thank you for listening. I appreciate everything you do for me. Having enemies is always a good thing. It keeps you honest. It keeps you on the straight and narrow. It's important. And criticism, so long as it's intelligent and rational and constructive, is always a good thing. These are just things that I say and just to get other people thinking. What can I take from all of this? How can my thought process be changed for the better because of this? So I want to thank my listeners. I want to thank everyone at the Voice of Reason for making this happen. And I will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
tuned in to Radio Aryan.